The market is an institution in which wealth acquires power. Wealth controls what gets produced and who gets it. So, for example, if a rich person wants a Mercedes-Benz to be produced and shipped to him, and you want a Mercedes-Benz produced and shipped to you, guess what? Your wish has no power because you don't have any wealth. The wish of a person with wealth will determine that the Mercedes-Benz is produced, that the workers will do the work, that the materials will be gathered, the technology will be developed. They shape society because a market is an institution set up to pander to serve wealth. So wealth acquires power when the institution is a market. So socialists and communists looked at capitalism and said, we are horrified ethically, morally, politically, but even in terms of the economic consequences of allowing small numbers of people to own the bulk of the wealth, particularly the productive wealth, and equally to allow those with wealth to have disproportionate power over the economic system through markets as a mechanism of distributing. We oppose, here we go now, the private property in means of production, and we oppose markets. Very important. So what then do socialists and communists define as what they want in the 19th and 20th centuries? Here's what they say. We want to take the means of production away from the small number of people who have concentrated the ownership. And the phrase they used was to socialize the property, to make it the property of the whole society, not of a minority within it. And likewise, the socialists and communists said, we don't like markets. We would rather have the productive resources and the products that come out of them and out of labor on them be distributed according to a completely different system. Not the market. Goods should not be given to the people who are the richest. Goods should be given by some other criterion. And the one that most socialists and communists came to like, famous quote of Marx's, we distribute to each according to their need. So the distribution will not be how much money have you got to buy it, but the distribution will be who needs it, who needs how much of it. So if you have 5 children, you get more milk than if you have 2. If you have 6 people in your family, you need more space to live than if you have 3, etc., because you have some criterion of need. So socialism and communism came to be understood as, okay, we have capitalism, private ownership by a minority of the means of production, markets as the system of distribution, but we want socialism and communism, which is socialized ownership, everybody's the owner, and instead of markets, we're going to have, and this is the word that came to be popular, planning. We're going to plan the use of the resources and plan the distribution of products according to some criterion of social need or social usefulness. So then the question for the socialists and the communists, once they had made clear what they didn't like about capitalism, morally, politically, economically, and what their alternative looked like, then the next question for them to answer, which they did, was, how do we go about achieving the change we want? What are we going to do? And here there began to be a bit of a split between the socialists and the communists. I don't want to overdo this, but there was the beginning. There were really 2 ways to think about making the change that socialists and communists all discussed for the whole of the 19th century and for the whole of the 20th century. The first way to make the change, I'm going to call using universal suffrage, or if you like, using the ballot box, or if you like, using parliamentary means. Here was the idea, inherited already from the 18th century, that the world was becoming a place where the average person had a voice. He, she could vote. And since the mass of people could in some sense hope sooner or later to take control of the government because they were the overwhelming majority in a world where universal suffrage was either there already or coming, there were many socialists and really quite a few communists too who said that's how we're going to do it. We're going to make the change as follows. We're going to mobilize and organize the mass of people to take advantage of the democratic universal suffrage in order, and this is crucial, folks, now, to capture the state. We're going to win office. We're going to become the parliament, the Congress, the president, whatever. And once we have the state, we will have the combination that can't be defeated. We'll have the mass of people mobilized, and we'll have the government. And that will give us the strength to push through the changes that we want. To take the property from the small number of rich capitalists and make it social. And just to show you how much the state played a role, the very word socialization began to shift in the 19th and 20th century and became nationalization. We're going to nationalize the means of production. That's just a way for you to see that the notion of the state as the key instrument was taking shape across the 19th and 20th century. So for many socialists and communists, we're going to get the state. With the state, we can do it. The people in the state can overwhelm, if you like, the power and the wealth of the capitalist class. The communists, and some socialists, tended to, at least to some degree, favor a second way. Not so much through the ballot, not so much through voting, and not so much through suffrage, but through words like insurrection, revolution, rebellion. And the idea here was, oh, look, these capitalists are not going to give up. They're not going to go quietly. They're not going to accept electoral defeat. They'll either figure out ways to prevent us from winning at the ballot box, or if we do, they'll prevent us from having the state power even when we win. And so we have to be prepared, we socialists and communists, the argument went, to take another step. We have to, phrases that became popular, seize the state, smash the state, overthrow the state. Fancy words, but they just mean seizing the state, but not only or even not in the main through electoral passages, especially if those were blocked. And so you had debates. Which of these two you should use as your primary way? What mixture of them if you did both? But I'm not interested in that debate very much because I'm more interested in what they shared. Both of these two shared that the trick is to capture the state. The way we're going to do this is we're going to get the state. And with the state, redistribute the property and substitute planning for the market. What this meant was that by the end of the 19th century already, and certainly by the early years of the 20th century, these positions had hardened into pretty fixed attitudes. Socialists and communists agreed that the problem of capitalism was a distribution of property and markets, that the solution was to socialize or nationalize the property and to substitute planning for markets. All they disagreed on was the extent of this. So, for example, socialists disagreed a little bit. We should do more of the electoral stuff and a little less of the insurrection. And the communists were more, tended to be, more on the insurrection side. And they had another small disagreement. I think small. But some of you may think it's big. The socialists tended to become, particularly across the 20th century, comfortable with the idea that we socialists will win at the election, and we will take over the state, and then we will control, limit, regulate. But we really don't have to take the property from the private capitalists. We can kind of hem them in. And that way, if we don't take it away, they won't fight against us so hard, we won't have a terrible struggle, and we'll get kind of socialism slowly. Whereas the communists tended to say, no, 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 no. You leave those private people in charge of the business. Even if you hem them in with rules and regulations, they'll wiggle out. So you got to get rid of that. You got to make the, here we go now, make the enterprises part of the government. The government is going to take over and operate the enterprises as government enterprises, so there's no separate private capitalist class anymore. So the socialists tended to control and limit private capitalists, and the communists tended to displace them with state officials. So European social democracy, France, Germany, is socialist, often winning, controlling, limiting, maybe even taking over a few enterprises, but the bulk of private enterprises are left in place, but the government takes a commanding position. Whereas in the communist governments, they tended, not 100% at all, but they tended to get rid of the private capitalists and substitute state officials. Now, why do I stress this? I stress this because with this idea of what socialism and communism was, when the revolutions happened, say in Russia, or China, or Cuba, or when communist regimes arrived, not quite by revolution, as say in Eastern Europe because of the post-World War II settlements, what was done in these countries was, predictably, they did what they believed. If socialism was different from capitalism in terms of ownership and markets, what did they do? They tended to limit, control, or eliminate private ownership, and limit or control markets. And they substituted state control, state ownership, and state planning. Of course, that's what they did in Russia, that's what they did in China, that's what they did in Cuba, that's what they do. That's what they do because that's what they believe. Sincere, honest, that's they did what they thought socialism and communism were as different. So let me give you the graphic example of the Soviet Union. It's 1917. This is a fanciful reconstruction. If you're actually interested in what the soldiers and workers are doing, there are fantastic books on the Russian Revolution of 1917. Everything from the impressionistic book of an American journalist who lived there at those days and wrote a famous book that has been famous ever since called 10 Days That Shook the World, the American newspaper man named John Reed, R-E-E-D, which you can get. It's in lots of editions, give you a very concrete sense of the kind of the chaos of the revolution in the streets in 1917. On to very famous studies of the revolution, one of the most famous, Leon Trotsky. Others written by leaders of the revolution, not all as sharp-witted as Trotsky was, but nonetheless, fantastic books about that. British historians were very, very good. E.H. Carr, C-A-R-R, wonderful historian. Maurice Dobb, D-O-B-B, an economist who has still the best book on what the Russians did in their revolution. But to condense all of that, here's what happened. The workers, together with the returning soldiers, because remember, the revolution happens at the end of World War I, a war that Russia lost. So the army comes back, the economy is destroyed, the countryside is destroyed, the government is a complete disaster, the government of the Tsar. And so there's a revolution of people who are hungry, who are furious about the war being lost, who are furious about the economy being destroyed. And the workers and soldiers together create a new society, basically. They create a new government. They form little groups, little councils to run the country because the government is defunct. By the way, the Russian word for council, little council of people, is the word Soviet. It's just a word for a council of people. So it's the union of Soviet socialist republics. That is, republics based on groups of working people getting together to run the society. Okay, here's what they did. My little fanciful story. Imagine a group of workers at a locomotive factory or a glove factory or anywhere in Moscow or St. Petersburg, which then becomes Leningrad. They wake up one morning, the revolution is here, they say, that's it, the revolution. The managers of the factory come in and they say, go away, Vladimir, you're not the manager here anymore. And the owners of the factory arrive to sit in their nice office and the workers say, go home, this is no longer your factory. We are, here we go now, we are taking the factory where we work in the name of the Russian people, and then we're going to march, all of us workers, leave the factory, we're going to march to the palace, the old palace on the edge of the city, where Lenin and Trotsky and the others are doing their organizing of the revolution, and they arrive there and they say, we have made the revolution in our factory, and we are here to deliver our factory and our work to the Russian people, but particularly to the new revolutionary government built up on the Soviets, to which we pledge our loyalty. This is no longer the private property of the Smolny family or whoever owned this factory or some foreign corporation. And we don't have no more managers that they tell us to run, none at all. This is a factory of workers that is now part of the wealth of the Soviet Union, and our activity here, what we produce, what's done with our product, is now going to be planned by the new Soviet government. They felt very good. This is on a Monday. They felt very good. They went home. Tuesday morning, all those workers got up, walked back to the factory, picked up their tools, and went back to work, making whatever it was. The question is, who ran the factory? They asked, and Lenin and Trotsky complied, send us some people who are representatives of the Soviet new government who will coordinate what we do here in the factory making whatever with all the other workplaces that are going to be organized this way. In other words, you plan what's going to be produced and what's done with the output. Because you, we, us, now own the means of production, socially, collectively, and our government will plan no more markets. Guess what they did? That's what the workers wanted to do. That's what the leaders hoped and expected they would do. It was a meeting of the minds. Nobody manipulated anybody else. But here is the thing, the most important thing for today. Neither in the minds of the leaders, and we're talking leaders like Lenin and Trotsky, some of the most brilliant minds ever to contribute to the Marxist theoretical tradition, people who wrote many books, people who had insights that, you know, most of us can't hope to have. Real remarkable leaders, remarkable thinkers, remarkable people. None of them asked the following question. Have we altered inside the production process the way surplus is produced? Who produces it? Who gets it? What's done with it? Have we transformed the work experience? Have we transformed the relationships inside the production units of our society? And my punchline, because we have a little bit of constricted time today, and we'll take a little at the beginning of next Tuesday. But what I want to drive home is, the answer is, the workers didn't expect that, and the leaders didn't think about it either. That's not what socialism and communism meant to them. In fact, Lenin and the other leaders then pressured and begged the workers, we're going to be attacked by all the capitalist countries. You must work harder than you did before. We need more output to save ourselves and to save our revolution. And for the next 30 years, they got more work out of Russian workers than anyone imagined they could. That's how the Soviet Union survived. Every worker was made to believe, correctly, that the revolution's survival depended on him or her. And they put in crazy hours, and they put in unbelievable creativity. But they didn't change the organization of production. What did that mean? Well, here we go now. It meant that the workers in Russian industry after the revolution were in, now I'm going to use Marxist language, the same class position that they were in before. They were in a new wealth position. They were part owners of the whole means of production. They had never been that before. That was a big change. Through their political party, the Bolshevik Party, they had power. They never had that before either. But their position in the organization of production had not changed. They came to work. They produced a quantity of output larger than what they themselves got paid as their wages. They produced a surplus, as we saw the first day we met. And the surplus was not appropriated by themselves. The surplus was appropriated by other people. They weren't a board of directors elected by shareholders. That was over. They were instead a group of officials, they were called commissars in Russia, sent down by the government, which the workers had asked for. They didn't change the internal organization of production. They changed property, they changed power, but they didn't change what I think Marx meant by class, his contribution. That it has to do with how we organize that experience 8 hours a day, 5 or 6 days a week, throughout our adult lives, where we work and produce goods and services. And so, to anticipate where I'm going with this, I'm going to back up in a minute, but to anticipate, I'm going to make an argument with you through the details of Soviet history, which I'm going to take you through. I'm going to make an argument that because the Soviet Union stopped at the point of radically altering the distribution of property, a stunning, world-changing historical change. I am no Monday morning. I'm not poo-pooing or undervaluing the change they made. Imagine taking the property, which they did, from all the private owners of industry in Russia at that time, and making it the property of the nation as a whole. Wow. And I do not undervalue that they took the power away. The Tsar was gone. The Russian Orthodox Church, which governed Russia with the Tsar, was effectively gone. Instead, a workers' political party, together in an alliance, that's the Bolsheviks, in an alliance with the most radical party among the peasants, something called the Socialist Revolutionary Party, that those two parties made an alliance and took over the power in the society. That's a spectacular change. That's like if Mr. Bloomberg were to leave and the Brecht Forum were to take over. Right? Fantastic change. I'm going to argue that those changes in the property and the power distribution, profound, radical, could not be preserved, could not be sustained, and could not survive because they weren't accompanied by that other change in the organization of production, and that was why Marx talked about it. Because he understood that. He understood that what had made it impossible, if you remember what we did last time, what had made it impossible for the revolution in France in 1789 to realize its goals of liberty, equality, and fraternity, that something similar had proven to make it impossible for the Soviet Union to realize its ideal of a new socialist or communist commonwealth. It had not attended to the reorganization of the workplace. it hadn't understood Marx's argument that the core of capitalism lies in the relationship called exploitation, where a lot of people produce a surplus that somebody else gets and disposes of. And let me save myself and you a lot of time. If it's in your mind that, given the conditions in Russia in 1917, if they had tried, if they had dared to cause the disruption in society that would have followed by saying in every factory, you workers are now going to run it yourselves. Remember, Russian workers at that time are overwhelmingly illiterate, no education, etc., etc. If you say to me that was an unworkable plan, I'm not going to disagree with you. I think there were a lot of reasons it didn't happen. I'm not arguing that it should have. I'm just pointing out it didn't. And by not doing it, whether or not it was possible, I don't know. My guess is if I had lived at that time, I would have thought exactly like those people did, and it wouldn't occur to me. But we have to learn from the fact that the Soviet Union is gone, and the fact that China is very different, and that it's touch and go whether any of the other socialist economies are going to stay that way very long. I don't know how many of you read, but if you follow what's going on, say, in Korea or in Vietnam, the direction of development is something that ought to give you pause. So we do have to ask the question and answer it. What happened? Why did the society in the Soviet Union collapse, implode on itself? Why has China changed the way it has? And again, I urge you to consider the possibility that not having altered the structure of production, not having been able, not at the beginning, in the middle, or even at the end, to reorganize production so that the people who do the work appropriate themselves collectively the surplus they produce. That was Marx's argument. All right, in the time we have remaining, roughly a half an hour, I'm now going to show you this analysis looking concretely at the history of the Soviet Union. I'm going to use class categories because I don't have much time, and I want you to see class analytics in action. So we're going to begin by asking, what was the class structure of Russia just before the revolution? So what was the society that went through a revolution in class terms? Okay, first, it's a wonderful illustration because you're going to see that there were different class structures coexisting and interacting with each other, which, if you recall, I told you is true of all societies. But let's do Russia, 1913, 14, 15, 16, as an example. Let's begin in the countryside. In the countryside, which is where 95% of Russians lived, this is in 1914, 15, Russia is a much more backward and a much poorer country than almost anywhere in Europe. It's overwhelmingly farmers. Peasants, people living off the land. Roughly, I would say 95% of the economy is agricultural. So let's look at the class structure. First, we have large numbers of what I define for you as the ancient class structure, or to use the modern language, the self-employed. Millions and millions of little Russian peasant families, where one individual, man or woman, women lived longer than men. There's a long, complicated history in Russia. But nonetheless, individual produces goods and services, produces a surplus that individual themselves gets and disposes of. It's a self-employed class structure. Millions of acres of Russian soil, millions of communities, millions of Russians lived in that class structure. Second, a smaller number of Russians had already developed agricultural capitalist enterprises. What does that mean? It means you have a farm in which there is an owner-operator, a Russian peasant, who hires other people to work on the farm, to run the machines, to take care of the animals, to cultivate the fields, and so on. This is a capitalist enterprise because the workers are hired for a wage. They produce something which is the property of the farmer who hires them, who sells it and keeps the revenue. It's a perfect analog to a capitalist enterprise outside of agriculture. Third, make life even more complicated. In scattered parts of Russia, there existed, as there had for centuries, communes. They were even called that. Communes. Villages. The Russian word often used is a famous Russian word, mir, M-I-R, which means peace and many other things in the Russian language. These were communes, groups of peasants who cultivated as a collective, who together produced a surplus that they themselves appropriated and distributed as a group. That is a communist class structure. So on the countryside, you had ancient capitalist and communist. Let's turn now to industry. Industry was overwhelmingly capitalist in Russia. It was relatively new. Russian industry hadn't developed for a long time. So most industry producing things had a capitalist, a board of directors if it was a corporation, large numbers of workers that were hired, commodities produced, the corporation took and sold, just like a corporation in the United States today. The interesting thing about Russia before the revolution was that the majority of capitalist enterprises in Russia were owned by non-Russians. It was Europeans who had moved in to take advantage of cheap wages in Russia and set up enterprises. So when the Russian Revolution hit, it had a capitalist class, but most of it was not Russian. In fact, the one country with the biggest investment in Russian industry was France at that time. Now, who makes the revolution? Two groups make the revolution. First, a tiny political party that is strong among the workers in the largely foreign-owned industries in two or three places, Moscow, Leningrad, and the oil fields in the area called Baku in the south of Russia. The Bolshevik Party, Lenin, Stalin, Trotsky's party, was a party of the proletariat. The proletariat didn't include 5% of the people. It's a tiny party in a tiny part of the Russian economy. It's the junior partner in a revolutionary alliance. A much larger party is the Social Revolutionary Party. A completely different political party, not led by Lenin, Trotsky, or any of others, other leaders. A party exclusively of peasants. Why were they in a revolutionary party? The answer was, while they farmed their own pieces of land, they didn't own the land, many of them. They had to rent the land from somebody else. They farmed it themselves. They produced a surplus. They got the surplus. But a part of the surplus they had to pay to the landlord, otherwise he'd throw them off the land. And the landlords were squeezing them. And what they wanted was to be free of the landlords. So they made a deal. These revolutionary peasants and their large party, together with Lenin, Trotsky, and Stalin, the leaders of a working class industrial proletariat party that was more organized, more cohesive, but much smaller. And here was the deal. We, the Bolsheviks, Lenin, Trotsky, and my apologies for those of you for whom this is all new, but if you live in the United States, the chances of your understanding from any source whatsoever, anything about the Soviet Union that isn't a fanciful morality tale about good and bad is very small. So don't blame yourself. Now we're finally coming out of a 75-year Cold War fog, so you can begin to hear. But I'm not telling you anything that any good history will not teach you as well. So here was the deal. We will ally with you, the Peasant Social Revolutionary Party said, on one condition. You must commit to getting rid of the landlords and making sure that a new revolutionary government, here we go now, gives absolute guarantees to the private property of every Russian peasant. He will get his own piece of land. He won't have to be beholden to a landlord. We do not want capitalism in the countryside. We do not want communism in the countryside. We want, I didn't use this word, but you, because we have the class analytic with us here today, you understand they demanded the self-employment model. It's as if you had a movement of agrarians in America that said, no more big farms, no more sprawling suburbs. The agriculture of America is going to be rebuilt on the family farm, from California to Idaho to Iowa to Maine. That's what they did. And the Bolsheviks said, yes, we'll do it. But you have to give us in exchange, it's an alliance, quid pro quo, you have to give us the mass support of the peasants when we take the industrial property away from the industrialists, make it the social property of the whole country. They're going to come after us with everything they got to destroy us if we do this. And the only hope they have is if they can mobilize the mass of the Russian peasants, illiterate, very religious, within the frame of the Russian Orthodox Church. You have to be the bulwark that at least gives us a chance to survive. Done, said the social revolutionaries. And in 1917, these two parties together made the revolution. The revolution was made by an alliance of two parties, and the first governments were alliances of the two parties. The idea Lenin and Trotsky did it is wrong. It's just ignorance. And the first thing the revolutionary government did, just so you know, is distribute the land to the Russian peasants as their private property. So the idea that the Soviet Revolution obliterated private property, anyone who says that to you is a moron, is a person who is so lost in the Cold War fog that they think inside of a model. It's just silly. It's just silly. The Soviet Revolution was unthinkable without the commitment to private property, and it delivered on that private property. It distributed, by the way, the slogan of the Russian Revolution, bread, peace, and land. Those were the three words. Remember, like liberty, equality, fraternity for the French Revolution? Bread, peace, and land. Bread, we're going to feed the people. Peace, we're going to get out of the war so nobody dies. Land, we're going to distribute the land as the private property. And from 1917 until 1929, the first 12 years of the Soviet Union's existence, the land was privately owned by the individual peasant, who not only owned it, but had the right to sell it.
When?
1917 to 1929. 12 years, first 12 years. I'm going to tell you in a few minutes what happens in 1929. Okay? So the Soviet Union, what did it now do? It made a revolution that actually strengthened the ancient class structure in Russia, spread it to many more people, and guaranteed it as a matter of government policy. It did not establish a communist class structure in the 95% of its population that were rural. It didn't propose it, it didn't advocate it, it didn't do it. It guaranteed private property. And it also, very quickly, starting in 1921, guaranteed markets in the countryside where the private property of the peasants could be used to produce goods that they bought and sold at a market. So the idea that the Russian Revolution got rid of markets and private property is false. It's make-believe. Industry, very different. Industry was not organized as individual self-employment, not at all. Nor was industry organized as communes in the manner that some of those farmers had been that I told you about for generations before. Instead, the industries, the factories, taken away from their private owners in 1917, were reconstituted as state enterprises. That's what they were called, state-owned enterprises. The private board of directors elected by the shareholders disappeared. The Russian Revolutionary Government said to the shareholders, you can take those pieces of paper, those shares, and the only thing we can think of that you might do with them is tear them into little strips and keep them in the bathroom for you know what. But they no longer are a claim to own anything. The revolution, early in the revolution, within the first few weeks, closed the stock market, which only opened again in 1991 or two. was closed for the whole history of this. There is no stock market. Your stocks are worthless. So shareholders do no longer elect the board of directors because shareholders have no power to do anything. Their pieces of paper mean nothing. So the board of directors is no longer elected by the shareholders. Who runs the enterprise? A specialized group of people elected or selected by the new government, the revolutionary government. They put people in that position called commissars, commissioners in English, commissar in Russian, and they run the enterprise. So the enterprise is no longer a private capitalist enterprise, but it is, and this is a concept I want you to think about, a state capitalist enterprise. Its ownership has changed from private to state, but its organization remains a mass of people producing a surplus that a different group of people get and dispose of. And this is not a plot. This is not a sleazy deal. This was what everybody thought the revolution was about, to change things from private to state. Okay? So here we have the first dozen years of the revolution, self-employment in the countryside, state capitalist enterprise in industry. You get the picture? The communist revolution established no communism. With one exception. Young people who had been active in the revolution were very unhappy that their dreams of a communist collective lifestyle wasn't being realized. And like young people often do, they spoke their mind. And Trotsky, Lenin, Stalin listened to the young people. And what they did was they developed a special fund to allow people who were interested in it to set up communist enterprises. Not in the countryside in agriculture. Not in the cities in industry. Where? The answer, in households. There began to be an explosion of communal, they were often called communal or collective households, where large groups of young people, 10, 30, 80, lived together. Together divided all the work from cooking and cleaning and shopping and childcare and healthcare and whatever else was to be done in the house, and to specifically organize it in a collective manner. Not self-employed, not feudal, nobody was the master, nobody the serf, equals. And the greatest book I know about it, written by a Princeton scholar named Richard Stites, S-T-I-T-E-S. You look it up, you'll find it. Richard Stites, I forget what the name is, you'll see it, Utopian Households or some name like that. Stites, Richard Stites, S-T-I-T-E-S. You'll also get a little bit of it by a woman historian who wrote a book about the history of women in the revolution. Her name is Wendy Goldman, G-O-L-D-M-A-N. If you take the book that I have here, Stites and Goldman are all in the bibliography here. You can track it all down through here. Okay. What happened then next in Russia was that this complicated economy, this complicated class structure, was both successful and a disaster all at once. Here's the success. They came back from the disaster of a failed world war that they lost, that was fought on their territory. A catastrophic revolution fought on their territory, followed by a civil war fought on their territory, and a foreign invasion. A foreign invasion. I always like to make sure you all got that. Britain, France, the United States, and Japan invaded the Soviet Union in 1918 to destroy the revolution. So just for the record, as Americans, think a minute. The United States was never invaded by the Soviet Union. The reverse cannot be said. They were invaded by the United States military. The military stayed for varying periods of time. The Japanese didn't leave until 1922, 4 years later. The invading armies allied with the White Army in the Russian Civil War. White Army then to the Red Army. So they came back from all of that and they rebuilt their country. That's a success. They solidified a Soviet government no one thought was possible, including most of them. They survived, which, given all the conditions and all the enmity around them, is itself an achievement. On the other hand, tensions were building up, very big ones. First of all, in the countryside. With the little independent peasants, something was happening that theory should have told them might happen, but that we now know in economics. When you have lots of little peasants, all of whom has enough land to farm his or her land, you're very vulnerable. A bad harvest, too little rain, too much heat, you get sick, your donkey dies, whatever it is, you don't have any slack. And if you can't make it, how are you going to survive one season? The only answer is you sell the one thing you really have to get through the hard time. What do you have? Your land. But if you sell your land, then you have no way to survive. How then are you going to survive when you've eaten up what your land got you when you sold it? The answer, the only way to survive is to go and offer the really last thing you have, which is your ability to work. And who do you go and offer it to? Well, the people who had enough money to buy the land from you. You continue to work the land, but no longer as your own self-employed piece of land, but as the laborer for another. In that act, by each individual peasant who must sell, there is a transition from the self-employed class structure to the capitalist class. The fact that the people engaged in this transition couldn't identify it as that doesn't mean anything. Consciousness is a different matter from what it is you're actually doing. So there began to develop across the 1920s in Russia a growing capitalist class of farmers. Those who were successful and could buy the land from the less successful and then hire them. And as they hired more and more people, they became richer. And you began to have what's called a class differentiation on the countryside between those who are still trying to hold on as self-employed peasants, who were surrounded and threatened by the more powerful, richer peasants who had workers, who could buy machinery, who could therefore produce stuff cheaper than the self-employed person and put him out of business. This became a powerful tension between different parts of the agricultural class. Moreover, the capitalist peasants who were accumulating wealth and were hiring workers, they didn't like all this talk from Moscow and Leningrad about socialism and communism, about the awfulness of capitalists. They weren't stupid. They recognized that was about them. They were, by the way, private capitalists. That's what they were. In 1929, Stalin, then the leader, because the fight between him and Trotsky had happened a few years earlier, Stalin reached the conclusion with his advisors that the capitalist farmers of the countryside were becoming a political threat to the regime. They were the enemy of the base of the revolution, those self-employed peasants who hated them. They were becoming the key producers of agricultural stuff and beginning to hesitate to send it to the city. They didn't want to feed the industrial machine that threatened them. So Stalin made a decision, very fateful decision. I can't, he said, I can't allow the continuation of this development of capitalist class structures in the countryside where still the majority of Russians live. So Stalin made a decision with his advisors to do something we now call the collectivization of agriculture. In 1929-30, those are the key years. That's what was done. The Russian government, the Soviet government, went into the countryside and basically, by persuasion but also by force, overthrew, if you like, the capitalist farmers that had developed, often bloody, often violent, gathered the remaining self-employed peasants and said to all of them, we have to reorganize agriculture. We can't go on. And here's how we're going to do it. And then they set up two kinds of class structure. Really interesting. Class structure number one were called state farms. They run exactly like a capitalist enterprise. But it's a state capitalist enterprise. The state sends in the top people, like it does in industry. And the rest of the people working on the land are going to be employees, agricultural proletarians. That's the smaller part of Soviet agriculture after collectivization. But here's the biggest part. They set up something called collective farms. The government, Stalin's government, gathers large numbers of peasants, numbering anywhere from 50 to maybe 1,000 or 2 or 3 or 4,000 even, into collective farms, private enterprises. They owned their own land. They farmed collectively. A good number of them were what we would now call communist class structures. The workers worked together, produced a surplus, and together decided what to do with the surplus. The only time a communist class structure was tried in Russia was in agriculture in the 1930s. After a while, Stalin was frightened by them because they were beginning to become critical and an alternative power base from his own, and so they were quietly folded into state farms. By the end of World War II, by the modern era, the last decades of the Soviet Union, you had state capitalist enterprises in industry and state capitalist enterprises in agriculture. The short experiment on the collective farms, some of them, of a communist class structure was just that, a short experiment. Other than that, communist class structures were not part of the Soviet experience. When the Soviet Union fell apart, when the property stopped, the industrial property, stopped being the property of the country and became privatized, which it has been going on now for 20 years, when planning that the Russian government did started giving way to more and more markets, which has also been happening over the 20 years, we see, culminating, of course, in the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1989, but this process started earlier, we see that the Soviets were not able to hold on to the changes in property and power that they had achieved. And so my argument, it had something to do with never having had the idea, the program, the project, the wherewithal to transform the internal structure. Another way to put this to conclude for today. Socialism and communism have tended in the last 150 years to be thought of in macro terms. We think of what the government is going to do, how the whole society will be changed from markets to planning, from private ownership to public ownership. We look at the big picture, the economy. We do not look at the production unit. Where was it written? Why would it have been done to act as though what happens in the bigger economy is crucial? But what happens on the ground, in the daily life of every worker in his or her workplace, that can just go on? That can just look like it did before, just with a change of personnel? It reminds me nothing so much as of the sad result of decolonization in the last 40 years in Asia, Africa, and Latin America. When masses of people wanted to drive the imperialists out, the British, the French, the Dutch, the Americans, whoever. We want enterprise not controlled, our economy and our destiny not controlled by the foreigner. So they got rid of the foreigners. And they put in their place locals. A local capitalist instead of a foreign capitalist. It's a difference, but it's not the difference they hoped for. It's not the freedom and liberation they had in their mind. They exchanged one capitalist for another. In the Soviet Union, they exchanged a private capitalist for a state capitalist. In the decolonialized territory, they exchanged a domestic capitalist for a foreign capitalist. Both have had to learn, and are still learning, that the problem isn't who the capitalist is. The problem is that there is one, and that the courage has to be found for socialists and communists to begin to rethink using the class analysis that Marx himself provides. The analysis of the organization of the surplus and how crucial that is through all three volumes of Capital to rethink and reposition socialism and communism. Last point for today. Let's be real modern here in the United States today. The mass of the American people, and not just the American people, are suspicious and dubious about socialist programs and socialist slogans and socialist literature. They have a very practical idea. The notion that the government, which is what these socialists keep talking about, is a reliable agent to bring a good society strikes them as ludicrous. They don't like the government. They see the government as not that different from big business. They don't have any confidence in the government. A socialist movement that keeps talking about how the government could do this and the government should do this is hitting a stone wall of 100-year experience that says, that's not a reliable gambit. That's not a good idea. Imagine a socialist movement which acknowledged this point and said, well, the reason the government has been screwing you is because it has no control at the base. There's no organized way for us at the bottom to make sure the state serves our needs rather than those of business. The way to weaken the control of business over the government and to enhance ours so the government works for us is if we ran the businesses ourselves, if there were no capitalists getting the surplus and using it to control the government. We got the surplus, we would use it to control the government, and we're the majority. So not only is this class analysis a way of re-understanding what happened in the Soviet Union and the history of socialism and communism, but it also offers a window into a transformed definition and strategy for socialism in the future of the United States, which is, whatever you think of it, more original, has more potential than anything else I see. When we gather next week, our topic will be using the class analysis in a completely different area yet again, a detailed analysis of the household. I'm going to use the United States. Class analysis inside the household, in the relationships between husband, wife, parents, children, elderly. What is going on? Is a surplus produced? You'll see that it is. Is it distributed? You'll see that it is. Does the production and distribution of surplus happen in different class forms? You'll see that it is. And you'll see what the consequences are. This is a new application of Marxian theory because Marxian class analysis, like conventional non-Marxian analysis, used to think that economics only applies to what happens outside the house, never inside. A bizarre idea, since production goes on inside the house. We produce goods and services, we distribute them, we consume them. The household is crucial. And so for the last 20 years, there's been a development of doing this.
And I trimmed a couple of minutes off the end due to time. The original, as usual, is available for download from our website, unwelcomeguests.net/626. If you'd like to download this or any previous shows, you can do so from our archive at unwelcomeguests.net/archive. Our theme music is by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. I appreciate all your email, and if you have comments on the episodes that are relevant to other listeners, please add them to the website. You may have noticed, if you listen carefully, Richard Wolf has made at least one slip up so far, which sharper ears than mine spotted. And I amended the website accordingly.